newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ding-a-ling-a-ling.
Media Project, a weekly opportunity for commentary and analysis on the media issues of the week, and sometimes when we're on our game, even some insight we try to offer. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. What do you say?
I say yo, and congratulations on a really big story in the Times Union as we speak about the governor of New York. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. We'll I suppose, talk about how these kinds of things happen. Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist and a former UAlbany professor.
Hello.
Hello, hello. And Judy Patrick, vice president of the New York Press Association, former editor of the Daily Gazette.
I am especially glad to be here this week.
Why is that?
Oh, you know, the coverage of the impeachment hearings, it's fascinating.
Well, it is. What do you think? You know, we might as well get right into that topic. Of course, there's a great advantage when you have an entity like NPR. You can do wall-to-wall coverage, right? You just let it roll, hmm?
Right. And I have been able to watch a lot of it on TV, and I've listened to it in the car when I'm out and about. What I've been really kind of concerned about, though, is the punditry that follows it. I find the actual testimony really interesting, but I'm really disappointed with what happens after the fact. I think the newspapers, sorry, Alan, but I'm going to stand up for the newspapers again. I think they're doing a stellar job of putting things in context, explaining, but actually just telling us the meat of the story. But I watched network people too often yesterday, you know, describe so-and-so's walking into the hearing room now. He's got, you know, he's going through the security. When you have time to fill, tell us some facts, put everything in context, because there's a million things the public needs to know, and that's the time to do it.
Judy, what is it specifically about the punditry that has bothered you? You know, I have my own thoughts on this, and that is that PBS and NPR have gone out of their way to bend over backwards to play the Republican position on the impeachment, to the point where I'm hearing from people, a lot of people, that it's too much, it's excessive.
And I hate it to the exclusion of presenting the real facts. I also hate the almost obsessive quality of discussing the president's strategy and responding to it. I don't care what his strategy is. I just want to know the facts of what's happening.
Hmm. Well, I think there are a lot of people out there who will not agree with you. They haven't been brought up to date on all of this. And Rex, you'll opine on this, I'm sure, but they've got a lot of space to fill.
Space to fill, indeed. Time to fill is really the big thing. I'm sympathetic to those TV people who are expected to keep talking. That's actually a flaw of the way America covers things on television. You know, when we see C-SPAN, we get bored. We want our attention span is such that we want it to be filled with more stuff. And that's, I think, why the commentators talk, because people want to have something to go on other than their own speculation. They don't know what to think unless somebody tells them to.
I think it's like a movie review or a play review. You go and see something and you have an opinion about it, and then you go read the reviews. And you're not reading it to find out what happened because you've already been. You want to find out if their opinion agrees with you. And we're attacking the media here, or criticizing the media here for how they cover it. I'm going to criticize the population. They need to know that their pundits come with a bias. And so you shop around, you listen to all of it. So, for example, when we're talking about it, it's like, oh, I listen to MSNBC and then I switch to Fox for balance. And wow, what's happening with PBS? I didn't expect that. That's what every citizen should be able to do. And it's not as if the population of the United States never did that. We did for many years when there were only newspapers. You knew which paper had which bias and you read it all to get an idea. This idea that one publication or outlet, and it will be your favorite, Fox or MSNBC, will give you everything, it can't be done.
But you know, we've talked about the mechanism of projection a great deal. And here, people have certain expectations of their outlets. Now, I've been hearing criticism of both PBS bending over backwards to the Republican side and, interestingly, NPR. So the minute you hear that, you begin to say, maybe this is what's wrong with the government giving any money to radio and television stations, because if they do, somebody's going to accuse them of being extra careful because of the money.
Is that what you're hearing? People are criticizing public broadcasting, thinking that they are?
Huh. Yes, they are. Now, of course, the American people are so divided, Rex.
Yeah.
That the minute anybody puts a Republican on or a Democrat on, you're going to hear from somebody, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely true. I think, actually, Margaret Sullivan, the fine media writer now for the Washington Post, former editor of the Buffalo News, and ombudsperson, public editor for the New York Times, Margaret had an interesting column leading into the impeachment in which she pointed out some of the downfalls the media could find. And her first point, I think, was to Judy's original criticism, and she said journalists need to stress substance, not speculation, because journalists and pundits love to ponder about how the public is reacting to the news, but they aren't much good at it. And so I think that is a good point. It's worthwhile to have a journalist who might say, just to review, this is what so-and-so said, but to then analyze it and say what this really means. Is that what's concerning you?
Yeah, and I'll concede that I was very disappointed with the PBS NewsHour the first night of their coverage, because I thought it didn't give me any of the substance, and it gave me a whole lot of Republican comments from the same old Republican people, so much so that even though I had watched the hearings all day, it wasn't a true representation of what happened during the day. And so if you happen to be a person who works 9 to 5, you weren't going to get a great sense of Bill Taylor's testimony and George Kent's testimony from that show.
You know, what's interesting to me is also Margaret Sullivan writes approvingly about the words of Jay Rosen, an NYU journalism professor who is frequently sort of a fly in the ointment in media criticism. He hates it when we use the word polarization, he says, because it's a false equivalence. We hear, oh, things are so polarized now, Rosen writes, when this is really about what's happened to the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. I think he may have a point, but I cannot imagine commentary after an impeachment hearing that, instead of saying we are polarized, says, look at what this Republican Party is like.
Well, yeah, that would be editorializing.
It would be
even worse trouble. I saw it yesterday when I listened to Devin Nunes in his opening address. And, of course, it was quite a contrast to Adam Schiff, who was dry and a recitation. As you must have liked that.
Because I did.
He rounded up everything that had happened so far and said, here's where we're going. It was all very factual and dry. And then Nunes comes out and gives this fiery, colorful, dramatically written speech. I hate everything about him, let me be clear, but his speech was fantastic, and it was a showstopper. And the New York Times said, oh, it was a rambling, silly, you know, that was editorializing. Because you...
Was that an analysis piece,
the
rambling? Really?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
So,
it was, you know, they were doing live coverage during the day. I watched it all on TV. I picked CNN to watch because they've been doing this stuff for so long, and I find them straight, and then I switched to Fox and to MSNBC for the extreme views. But that one struck me, that they didn't even portray... It was a review. It was definitely a review of a performance.
Well you know, Rex... And
I'm Rosemary.
No, I know.
He wasn't talking to you.
That's right. I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to
You're
Rex.
Ignoring me.
Not at all. Very hard to ignore. I loved something that Rex said, and I wanted to mention it in quoting Ms. Sullivan, and that is the concept of false equivalence, because I think that's the buy-in that has happened to so many of these places. They say, okay, if we're giving 10 minutes to this, we got to give 10 minutes to that, as if they are the same thing and they're an entitlement based on party affiliation as opposed to truth.
Right. That is a constant issue that is so difficult to deal with. And this does come down to the fact that we actually can document that the president lies, but when we point that out, we are then challenged sometimes by readers, by listeners and viewers to say, yeah, but what about the lies of Bill Clinton?
Right.
Well, of course, he was president some years ago, you know. We wouldn't be writing about that now. But that doesn't dissuade supporters of President Trump from being annoyed with us for not putting in that kind of equivalency, which would be, of course, false at this point.
And it actually has made me think, because there's been a lot out about the Clinton impeachment trial. As people go back, as journalists go back and do background in history, I never watched the Clinton trial. Or if I did, I don't remember it. Why not? Because I was glued to Nixon's. I was glued to this one. Is it because he was a Democrat and I voted for him? Is it true that we all are affected by our biases? Like, oh, that's silly. He's not really guilty of anything worth impeaching for. So I didn't watch it. I don't even know. And but it has made me reevaluate.
And let's try to remember, Rosemary, I want to talk to you about this now. I'm teasing, of course. But let's try to remember what the Clinton impeachment was about. It was about a stupid physical act in the White House, as opposed to leading the American people into a very dangerous pre-totalitarian state. Now, that is false equivalency in my mind.
Yes, maybe so, but they are both leading to the same action in Congress. And I think a critic of President Clinton would say it was not supposedly about the sex. It was about lying about the sex.
Right.
Yeah.
And
right.
Imagine that in those days we cared about a president lying.
Right. And the Democrats at that time said, okay, this was not good. You shouldn't be cheating on your wife. Naughty, naughty. But you don't impeach somebody for this.
Right.
That's exactly what the Republicans are doing right now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was like really dumb. He shouldn't have done that. But impeach him for it? No, let the people decide.
Yeah. I've been debating whether or not it would be productive for the networks to do some real-time fact-checking on the testimony. At one point, I thought it would be a good idea, but then I'm thinking fact-checking can itself be considered biased, and so maybe that's not a good idea. But there is a lot of need for better discussion of what's true and what's not.
Well, how could they not?
Okay, my head is exploding at the idea of fact-checking being biased.
Well,
that shows how what we have become.
Sure. Yeah. You know, it would be wonderful if we could have done real-time fact-checking on the Barr letter. You know,
yes.
When Attorney General
yes.
Barr put out his interpretation of the Mueller report, which set the stage for what the Mueller report turned out not to be. You know, how much did we say based upon what we thought was probably a truthful representation, we, the media, that is, how much was their coverage saying no collusion, no obstruction, when in fact that's not what the Mueller report said at all, but that is what the Attorney General said it said. If we only had been able to do real-time fact-checking on the Attorney General whose summary lied about the Mueller report, mm-hmm. then we would have been able to be doing better journalism about it.
Right? Yeah, we got snookered on that one, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's always this business about whether or not we are, you know, being unfair. But he was a liar. And it's too bad that you can't say Barr's a lying liar based on the facts that you don't even know the facts, so you can't even say that.
So what's our duty about Hunter Biden and the whistleblower, the Republican point? Should we be vetting him? And we know who he is. And should we be checking further into Hunter Biden? I think the Times and Atlantic already has done this, but I raise the question.
I think you're right. The stories that have been out there about Hunter Biden have looked into it. But it's not as though it's something that will ever satisfy those who are saying, yeah, the Republicans.
The critics.
The
mm-hmm.
critics, right.
Well, it's a tough one because Rosemary and I think, uncharacteristically agree on this, that Hunter Biden had no business being there. I mean,
right.
it has nothing to do with whether he did anything bad when he was there. I suspect the Times did a major investigation on that, and he didn't. Nevertheless,
yeah.
You know why he was there.
Of
he was
course.
The vice president's son, and they were trying to buy influence with the potential president of the United States.
If I were a Democrat in Congress right now, I'd be introducing a bill keeping the close relatives of high officials out of foreign business. I think it was wrong what Hunter Biden did. I think it's equally wrong that Donnie, Ivanka, and Eric are doing the exact
Absolutely.
Same thing right. and going around hypocritically criticizing Hunter Biden. It's just laughable
Imagine,
to see that.
It is really ridiculous.
Yeah, the president of the United States is touting little Donnie's book on his Twitter. Come yeah. on. That's benefiting from your parents.
Well, and there are
time-honored American tradition
of foreign countries doing deals with the Trump organization,
Ivanka,
which the president said his kids were going to be running. He was not going to run it anymore. Well, and then he's bringing his kids into the government. It's really a pot calling the kettle black if you bring in Hunter Biden.
So the point of view of the media and of our representatives is, yeah, you know what? This whole controversy has pointed out something that's wrong. Let's fix it. And,
uh-huh.
and we're not. We're not calling attention to that.
You would think that the emoluments clause would,
yes.
but apparently we kind of ignore that at this point as well. You know, we actually were snookered unknowingly, at least for a couple of days, in the description of the initial phone call, the initial description, that is, the phone call that the president had with the president of Ukraine, referring to it as a transcript. That wasn't a transcript. It was a White House
I thought the
document.
Media actually did that pretty clearly.
But
and indeed, the paper
days.
Itself has right on that front page, this is not a transcript, which... looks foolish.
I think people use the term.
I think we did a worse job saying that the whole controversy boils down to that phone call. It's become increasingly clear. That phone call was the culmination of a months-long campaign. And I'm not sure that that's clear. And the president keeps hacking it. That phone call was
perfect.
As if that was the only thing that's in question right now.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of a crawl along the bottom of the screen with facts? Hunter Biden was paid $50,000 a month. U.S. law allows Hunter Biden to get paid $50,000 a month. The U.S. gave Ukraine this much money in aid in 2015. Mm-hmm. Because while I'm watching, I thought to myself, well, what was the aid during the Obama administration? Is it correct what they're saying? And mm-hmm. I think a lot of people aren't going to take the time to read the websites or go to the newspapers and get those kinds
of
clarifications.
You know, if you watch NFL games, you get this immediate analysis. You know, there's this vast team sitting below the broadcast booth that is reviewing video, looking at statistics and so on, that is able to make these commentators sound really smart. Right into their headsets, right into the monitors in front of them, they can see something that they can point to and say, look at this. This could be the way that we cover debates.
This is brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, that's why it's not outlandish. A generation ago, Rune Arledge, who was in charge of ABC Sports, was put in
60 Minutes
in charge of in charge of news. And so bringing that sensibility of sports coverage into politics may have something to do. I could be a network president. You think, can I get a promotion now? You know, I think they're paid better than I am.
Talk about punditry. I was watching CNN, and on comes Dan Rather. Now, Dan Rather, who I interviewed a long time ago and is an impressive guy, is very old right now. And I don't know how
well,
old.
Well, I think he might be. It's a not relative term, don't you think, Alan?
He's not that much older.
No. Once you hit 80, you're old. Come on. Humans only live at the best to 100. And really, they're old. And he would say that himself. When he was at UAlbany, he spoke about his age. So.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I'm coming up on it fast. But however, people like Woodward and Bernstein, all these people who are appearing, do offer a tremendous amount of historical context to us. How is this like the Nixon proposed impeachment, which never happened, but was going to happen? How is this different from Watergate? Is it worse? I think it's much worse, by the way. And each of those things becomes important. So yes, I would argue, Judy, with you about the importance of this punditry, especially when it comes from people like that.
Right. Dan Rather is 88 years old, actually.
Oh, that is old.
FYI. I believe that's even older than you are, Dr. Chartok. Isn't that correct?
By 10 years, yes.
Wow. Amazing. So he is genuinely old, but not so much.
Right. there are pundits and there are pundits.
And diplomacy could be in your future, too.
That's the nicest thing you've ever said, Rex.
Yeah, I think it is.
There are hired guns on these network shows that are just, they just are paid to say inflammatory things that are not constructive. They don't add to the public's understanding of what's going on. That's what I have the problem with.
Yeah.
So, for example, give us an example. Like, I'll give you one. Rick Santorum. I wanted to throw.
Why is he on TV? I throw shoes at the television every time he goes. Right. He was never an effective senator. He couldn't run at all. Why
and
is he being called?
And they turned him out.
Yeah.
You know, he's defeated. Yeah. Why don't they put a chyron up there that says, defeated senator, Pennsylvania?
I guess that's true of Claire McCaskill, too, who's on television a lot these days.
But she's smart.
But why not put on a journalist who is trained, a professional, who really knows what they're talking about, knows the ins and outs, knows history, or really can add to the public debate. But instead, you get just talking heads.
All these.
Well, they love Santorum because obviously they want somebody who's going for blood, who will cause a huge brouhaha. They were yelling at each other so loudly, they had a panel of eight people, you couldn't hear a word of it because they're all so angry with each other, and I was one of
these big panels are just too frustrating. It's really a bad period in American television, I think, these big panels on cable news, because what they're looking for actually is a foil for the other person. They're looking for people who will say enough inflammatory to make good TV, right? Good conflict. And that's not useful for information. It's useful for entertainment.
Alan, you and I have to recuse ourselves because of the round table.
That's right.
You know, you make such a good point. I worked in the New York City Police Department years and years ago as an educational advisor to commissioner. And I shared an office with a guy named Philip A. Lacavara. Phil Lockhart is one of the brightest, I can say, leaned to the right of fellows. And they've had him on one of those, either CNN or MSNBC, I can't remember which. And he's great. He speaks in somber tones. He gives you legal opinion. And he doesn't show up that often because he isn't one of the screamers.
Well, thank you for this report from the LaGuardia administration. We really appreciate it.
His memory is pretty good for somebody who's old. Mature.
What's your name again?
This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. That's Judy Patrick. Rosemary Armeo is here. Alan Shartok and I'm Rex Smith. If you want to share your thoughts, we would welcome some thoughts, that is.
Yeah.
Media at WAMC.org is how you reach us. By the way, one of our listeners, Clifton, who is a town historian in Orange County, writes that he thought that we dealt with nothing new talking about the loss of newspapers. He's focusing on page 2 of the October 10, 1880 issue of The Sun, in which they lament the closing of so many newspapers, including the Coahomian of Mississippi and the Mud Turtle. Now, there's a fine
name. Yeah, that was a loss. I remember when the Mud Turtle died out.
But it's true, you know, it is true that there's still a lot of newspapers out there, but we're losing many of them, hundreds. But back in the 19th century, there were even more because it was a primary source of information. This was before radio, before TV. This is the source of entertainment for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I'm more worried about the future. It's not just the newspapers. It's the reporters who filled the newspapers. And those jobs are going away. The desire to do that kind of job is going away.
Yeah, is it more stressful now than it was 10 years ago?
I think the job is more stressful for reporting because
it's dangerous.
It's not,
more dangerous
it's,
now.
It's
than
more.
Used to.
I think you're right. It's more dangerous, even in this country where there isn't as much. There is some physical danger, but I think there's the emotional upheaval that's caused by the attacks on the media that we didn't have as much of. I was in a class at Columbia Graduate School of Journalism down in New York City where there were really
bright
students.
Didn't you graduate first in your class at Columbia?
Many years ago, I couldn't do that now because so much more is required of the students than were required, any more than you could qualify for a PhD, I'm sure.
Bam! Wow, that came out of nowhere.
That was mean.
Oh, no. There's so much that's required now of journalists that I think the stress, the pressure on them is really hard, right?
So I wanted us to talk about the story out of Northwestern, and this leads right into it.
Oh,
where
man.
The students did their job. They covered a protest. Protests are by nature protest public.
Yep.
They covered it. They contacted. They took pictures of students protesting. They took steps to find those students later and talk to them. And those protesters objected. They didn't want their picture in the paper. They didn't want to be interviewed. And so the student journalists apologized.
They signed a letter in their campus paper, all the top editors of the paper, saying, "We're so sorry that we disturbed you by reaching out to you by social media to ask your opinion. We're sorry that we depicted you protesting."
And then the journalists on Twitter piled on these poor college kids who really were on their own. They're college kids putting on a newspaper, even though they're fully entitled to do this thing. I really thought it was excessive what happened to them next.
They got a lot of criticism on both sides.
Yeah, they got hit from both directions.
So Judy and I, of course, have been talking about this, and we want to blame the faculty. The whole idea of a college journalist is to figure out these things and to deal with blowback, which is common.
But
from
this
people.
Is an independent newspaper. It's not affiliated with the Medill School of Journalism.
So there's no teachers of journalism there who work with them? With UAlbany.
No,
we still talk to the students.
This is a daily newspaper. This is the daily newspaper of Evanston, Illinois. And they put out their paper, and then they are very proud of their independence. I don't know that you can blame the faculty. They're not involved in the production of the newspaper.
I'll go back then if you want to hit it that way, Rex, and say, who trained them to go be student journalists?
You're right about that.
And they have that blowback from readers on both sides is a fact of life. It's part of the pressure we were just talking about. And you do not win votes you don't do journalism by apologizing.
Absolutely.
There's nothing to apologize for.
But I think that it's fine that the dean of journalism, actually,
great
at Northwestern,
letter.
Then, yes, he did. But he criticized them. He was thoughtful about it, but he said, they should not have issued this letter of apology. And I think that was good instruction on his part, wasn't it? Then?
Yes, I thought he wrote a terrific letter, but of course he was writing, he is a professional writing to other professionals. I'm more concerned about the students. If this kid, who was the editor-in-chief, came to the Times Union for a job, would you hire him, or how would your interview go, Rex?
You know, I've actually, I thought about that very specific question because we have the Hearst Fellowship Program. We bring in a lot of bright young people, including young people from Northwestern. Our managing editor, Casey Seiler, is a Northwestern graduate, though not of the journalism school. And we bring in these young people, and I've thought, what would I say to this guy? I would hope that he would have learned a significant lesson. I would hope that this will have strengthened him and given him a spine and have taught him how not to respond when he gets criticism, right?
How about you, Gina? Right, would you have hired him?
Yes, because I think people learn all the time, and this person is young. Again, I think he should have been taught this somewhere along the line, although maybe it's something we didn't need to teach 10 or 15 years ago.
That's
interesting. We do need to teach now because,
sure,
Rex, you get it. You have gotten it all the time, but you probably get it more so nowadays, this blowback.
Yeah, the blowback. And you're right, actually. The words that the students used in apologizing for their coverage were words like we triggered. I mean, I'm thinking of contemporary mm-hmm. terms that mm-hmm. speak to feelings and identities
sensitivity.
Being damaged. Yeah.
I remember when I first began teaching, and that was decades ago, that I thought students out of a timidity, I don't want to use courage, but a timidity would use ethics rules, for example, not to talk to people. It's hard to talk to people about stuff they don't want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you need a certain bitchiness, if I can say that word, to be a journalist. You need a certain drive to get at the truth
yeah.
and to overlook sensitive feelings. And not everybody has it. So it made me wonder whether any of the people on this newspaper will end up in news.
That's right. I occasionally have readers who come to me and say, well, your own code of ethics says do no harm. And I say, it does not say that. That's the Hippocratic Oath.
I'm not a doctor.
Code of ethics. Yes, I am not a doctor. I don't play one. Our code of ethics says, consistent with your truth-telling responsibility, try to minimize harm, but that doesn't mean you know that your reporting is going to harm people. You know that you're going to ask tough questions and
yeah.
make people unhappy.
Even if you're reporting on a car accident, if you write about a car accident, you are going to hurt the parents of a dead child.
Uh-huh.
That's unavoidable. Too much of news is like that.
But then, too, there's another issue, and that is that we all make relationships with sources. And sooner or later, you got to cross that source. That source is going to not be happy with you. I have that in Great Barrington, Massachusetts right now, where the chairman of the Board of Selectmen is writing me dirty letters because I called him out for a heinous sort of approach to silencing one of the people on the board. So one of the things you got to train people to do is to be alone. I mean, sooner or later, they're going to have to pay the price.
Very true. And on that point, we're going to have to call it a day because we are out of time from the Media Project. Alan Chartuck gets the last word. Rosemary Romeo, Judy Patrick, and Rex Smith, we are here with you. And our producer, David Gustina, is ready to bring on Heat. Thanks for joining us on the Media Project.